Welcome to the Life Self Mastery podcast, where we bring in entrepreneurs who have created online businesses and improved their lifestyles. Here's your host, Rohit Malhotra.
Hi everyone, I'm Rohit from lifeselfmastery.com, and today we have Allison Lee, who's the founder and CEO of Hemster, which is a tailoring solution on a mission to revamp a dying and outdated industry. Allison launched her first startup while in college at UC Berkeley, and since then has found her way to retail through Hemster. Hemster is an alumni of XRC Labs, which is an accelerator based out of New York. Welcome to the show, Allison.
Thank you so much for having me on the show, Rohit. This is Allison.
Awesome. So, you know, can you share your journey? You know, how did you get into tech startups, and what led you to start Hemster?
Sure, of course. So if you don't know my background, basically, I was never really into like a retail background. After college, I got right into, you know, data segmentation and data mining. So the last company I worked for was called Peel Startup. It's basically turns channel on your TV with your phone. So at that place, I really saw the power of data mining using the superior customer service and customer experience. And basically, once I joined the team, they were making about $20,000 a year. And I left after 2 years after growing the team to about $15 million. And when I left the company, I thought about two things. First thing was that, you know, they're framework of, you know, data mining using very ordinary experience definitely works, and monetizing that proprietary data was really interesting to me. So I started looking at other industries that I could plug in the same framework of thought, and looking at like the black box industries that could benefit from the data transparency. So that's kind of how I decided on retail, where I knew that, you know, all the retailers were suffering from, you know, sizing and fit issues, but their decisions are not really based on a lot of data. So if you look at how, you know, even the biggest brands, like somebody like Gap or Banana Republic, how they develop their sizes right now in US is they choose a real person who represents their medium. So they basically develop a size around this real person who might not represent majority, right? And then basically based on that, small, medium, and large sizes, which results in only fitting per population. So I thought about, what about 89% of US population who doesn't fit into this conventional small, medium, and large? And how can I help the retailers really bridge that gap between these pre-made sizes? So that was my main realization after leaving the company. But another realization, like personally, that I made was, you know, I was putting in like insane work hours into this company because I really love the product. I really love the team. But at the end of the day, you know, I noticed that my vision for the company mattered less. And, you know, what founders decided to do with the company basically like took precedence of what I wanted to do. So I decided to really, you know, like if I'm going to really work hard and slave away, I wanted to do it for my own vision. So I was job searching at the same time, but I thought to myself, I was like, you know what, why don't I take 1 year break? And I knew that I was really passionate about Hemster, the idea. I didn't really have a product or customers or anything like that, but I wanted to take 1 year break and then see how far it goes. And if it doesn't go anywhere, then that's fine. I can just find like a new job after a year. But once I started the company, it just kept on snowballing and growing faster than I could ever imagine. And this is my third year running it, and it's turning into kind of like a 7 year journey right now. But yeah, that's kind of how I started the company after being in tech for so long.
Interesting, you know. So, you know, before the show you talked about your background and how your parents influenced you to, you know, to get into entrepreneurship. So, did you come from an entrepreneurial background, or, you know, it's like with a lot of, you know, Asian Americans, you know, it's about, you know, getting great grades and getting high paying job. So what was your background about?
Yeah, I would love to share. So I'm a Korean American descent. So my dad's a psychiatrist. So I noticed more and more parallel between my dad's life and my life as I grow up. But he's had a very stable job his entire life. He's like a doctor in Korea. He grew up very, you know, he didn't grow up super wealthy, but he grew up with a very like loving family. Met my mom's a homemaker. She like never worked like a day in her life, right? Like in like a salaried job. But then they decided to take 1 year break, kind of similar to how I decided to take 1 year break, right? So mm-hmm. my dad said, hey, like I've been doing like a psychiatrist job for a really long time. Why don't I take a year break and just move to America? And we'll see how it goes. And if it doesn't work out, we'll just move back, right? Mm-hmm. So once he moved here, he kind of saw that me and my younger brother, we adjusted to American life really well. So I moved here when I was in eighth grade, which is a little bit later than typical immigrants, but I really loved like the US like educational system. I really liked how they focus more on like the critical thinking rather than like pure memorization. So my parents turned 1 year sabbatical into 7 years. And in the 7 years, obviously they were like, well, my dad like couldn't get certified again in America because he doesn't speak any English. So he was like, well, what can I do in this 7 year period? And he didn't even know he was gonna stay here for 7 years either. So he had three options. He was thinking about opening up like a gas station or opening up like a coffee shop, or he was looking at like a vending machine empire. So he ended up going with owning 100 vending machines in Southern California, like near LA. And he's never like ran a business before. My mom's never ran a business before, but I really admire him for just kind of like jumping into it and really like that spirit of like, I will figure this out like as I go. Like, I think that's something that can't be taught. That's like that is like definitely the entrepreneurial like hustle that everybody talks about, right?
Right.
So I remember my dad, he used to like, he bought this like the cargo van, and he converted my garage into kind of like a storage unit for all the snacks. So it was great for me and my brother. But yeah, like I basically grew up watching him like running this like a vending machine empire. And I helped him with like accounting. I helped him like managing his workers. And then my brother had to like go to Costco and like buy snacks with my dad. And then like he would literally go with my dad like every weekend and then just like restock these like 100 vending machines, right? So that venture, you know, he was like, I'm just going to do it for a year. That also turned into a 7 year journey. So I think about that a lot where, you know, my first year, you know, where I thought like it was just going to be a sabbatical, but it's also turning into like a typical like 7 year journey for a startup. So I think the biggest hurdle for, you know, anyone who's thinking about starting a business or thinking about, you know, like jumping into that side hustle is you're just stopping yourself, right? Because you're like putting too much pressure on like how it would do. And for me, like not thinking about it too much and just like kind of jumping into it and giving yourself like a really short-term deadline of like, I'm just going to like really focus on this for a year and see where it goes. That's been more effective decision-making process for me than like thinking about, oh my gosh, what if this, what if that? Should I do this? Should I not? And you're basically wasting that time that could have been spent in like growing your actual side business, right? So yeah, like I definitely learned, you know, the courage to jump into like an unknown from my parents. And you know, now they've sold that business, they've made a lot of money, and they moved back to Korea, and they're, my dad's a psychiatrist again. But he definitely talks about like how he wants to retire and like restart like a vending machine business. But yeah, it's like it's been like a very interesting full circle for our family.
Yeah, that's a great story, and you know, I think if you come from an entrepreneurial background, it really does help you out, and you know, because when you are younger, you know, help your parents, you know, those sort of experiences really, you know, get on to help you out.
Right. And you also learn that, like, the failure is nothing to fear for, you know, like, I think seeing kind of like the new venture as a journey, I've learned that from seeing my parents treating how they, you know, like jump into new journeys. They're not worried about failing. Like they don't even see it as like a failure. They're kind of like, I'm curious to find out how this would work. And there's nothing wrong in trying. So I think that's a really interesting like shift in perspective that I even notice in the founders around me. You know, people who kind of see it as like, Will I succeed or fail? I see a lot more roadblocks in their minds than people who just frame it as like a curiosity. And I'm just trying to figure out if this is working from my own perspective. And that keeps you more objective and that keeps you more honest to your traction and your numbers.
Interesting. I mean, you know, take it as an experiment for a year and see, you know, where this
leads. Exactly. Exactly.
Right. Got it. So, you know, let's talk about Hemster and, you know, who are your competitors and your customers? Because, you know, if I'm not wrong, you also have a patent pending solution which will help you customize ready-wear at scale. So, so are there other companies also trying to solve the problem the way you are trying to solve, or you have a certain sort of a moat in which, you know, you're trying to solve it in a unique way?
Yeah, no, that's a great question. So just to, you know, zoom back a little bit, basically what Hemster does is we offer modernized tailoring solutions to real estate properties and retailers. So what we've done is, you know, traditionally, if you think about tailoring services, you kind of have to, you know, travel to like a dingier shop where, you know, they might not really, you know, speak English or they might not really care about customer service. But you're buying these really high-end pieces, let's say from like even Michael Kors or True Religion jeans. You're paying like $200, $300 for these garments, but you're taking them to like an inconsistent experience. So what we wanted to do was taking that experience and upgrading it and plugging it right into your shopping journey. So imagine that you're, you know, basically shopping like at any of the high-end malls or even the stores, right? And you're trying on these jeans and you're like, hey, look, like I love the fabric, I love the colors, but it just doesn't fit me right, so I'm not going to buy it. But now the store associates, instead of losing that sale, they're able to basically close that sale using our alteration services. So they fit the shoppers in the dressing room as the shoppers are trying on their clothes using our ruler sticker. And the ruler stickers are more accurate and it's less intimidating than using like the pins and chalks that the traditional tailors use. And that's our patent pending solution. And once the orders are inputted, it basically gets aggregated to our collection point and it gets delegated to our local vendors. So another thing about tailors is that, let's say you go to one tailor and you bring like three different like types of garments. As like a woman, I could bring like one dress, one jeans, one blazer, right? But you're not sure if they have the right machinery or like the skill sets to do all three things as like one tailor. But what Hemster does is we basically identify like the best tailor for that specific garment. So we delegate like, If I find like a master tailor who's only good at doing like suit jackets, then we aggregate all the orders and we only send them suit jackets. So that's kind of how we guarantee the highest quality and like the fastest turnaround, is because we also streamline the workflow for these tailors. So we've partnered with, you know, the biggest mall operators in US, and these are the guys who are like Westfield, Simon, GGP, Macerich, Tubman, and altogether, they own about 500 grade A malls in US. So they, we can basically set up shop at any of these 500 mall locations. And on top of it, we work with like high-end retailers like The Reformation or Michael Kors, True Religion, Diesel, all these high-end denim people, but also like custom suit companies as well. So basically, we're plugging in alteration services at what was what was previously inaccessible by individual shoppers.
Got it. So, you know, when you talk about your customers like Ms. Zara, Michael Kors, mm-hmm. so are these your, you know, do you have some exclusive contracts with them, you know, a year-long contract, or, you know, are they, you know, when you talk about your revenue, so how much of these high-end, you know, retail operations like Zara and others, you know, contribute to your overall revenue?
Yeah, so overall, so we have two main forks. We have like the retail side and then we have like the residential side. It's about 50-50 right now. We're both growing on both forks very aggressively, but we're launching about 7 more malls across nation this quarter. And then on top of it, you asked about the retailers. So we have about 30 stores that we work with right now. And from there, we have a vendor contract if we are just purely doing alterations. But if we want to do something more like data passback or like the data integrations, then we have something more exclusive and more integrated contract with these retailers.
Okay. And so, you know, I want to talk about some of the numbers for M-Strobe. So, you know, what are the average order value and what are the, you know, revenue numbers you're doing, you know, MRR per month?
Currently we're live in 3 markets. So across 3 markets, we just passed our $50,000 monthly revenue. And then we just launched our 4th and biggest market, which is New York City. So with the New York City and also with Q4, we think we're going to reach about $150,000 in monthly revenue by end of this year. And you also, I think you also asked like the average order value. So for the retailer side where, you know, you're getting fitted in the dressing rooms, we have about $25 in average order value. But when you move into the residential side, when we are doing like in-home fittings and the in-person alterations, the average order value jumps up to about $175.
Okay, got it. And, you know, so how many customers and retail customers do you have, and what was the acquisition strategy that you had adopted to, you know, reach that sort of users as of now?
Yeah, so our distribution channel is really, so our user acquisition channel is really B2B2C, meaning that we partner up with our partners, the retail partners or like the real estate partners who are basically distributing our services to their tenants or shoppers. So from there, we see about 5,000 end users across 3 markets right now. And we are basically like acquiring users like through building more partnerships, like building more national partnerships. The latest partner we have is like the DVF, which is like a really high-end women's wear. And we have like a national partnership with them where they would be start using Hemster service across all of their stores in United States. And someone like, you know, Net-a-Porter or Mr. Porter, who is also a very high-end like e-commerce platform where, you know, they have a lot of like active shoppers. They're also launching our service exclusively to their VIP customers. So through these partnerships, basically we're acquiring users at no cost to us.
Got it. And so, you know, for investors, you know, what sort of returns and, you know, exit strategy can they look at if they invest into a Hemster?
Yeah, that's a great question. So, I mean, we as a company right now, we're growing 200% quarter over quarter, which is about 30 to 40% month over month growth. And that indicates that we are a venture worthy startup. And once you are hitting this traction with our, you know, full pipeline, we're basically on pace to hit like $10 million like monthly or annual revenue by end of next year. So, as an early investor, basically you're betting on, you know, each startups to make sure that you're growing explosively, you know, year over year. And we are charting to grow about like 20 to 30 times from this year to next year, which means that your return is also 20 to 30 times. So as an early investor, that's like the early signal that you're looking for. And on top of it, like We, as a company, we really focus on being a sustainable business rather than, you know, one of those like hype companies where, you know, it's more in the future. We want to solve the real problem now. So as a tailoring solution, we are seeing the early results from the retailers now, and we're able to grow really quickly through these partnerships and hopefully deliver even bigger growth as we are exploring tech options and data options with these early partners.
Okay, and you know, you have raised a certain amount of crowdfunding platform like Republic, and you've also you know, raised some angel funding. Would you like to talk more about the you know, the funding, and for what use are you going to use this this money for?
Yeah, so great question. So on the crowdfunding platform, which is Republic, we've raised total about $170,000 so far. We have still like 2 months to go, and our main like marketing push is still yet to come. So we're hoping to close closer to, you know, $250,000 to $300,000 on that platform. And additionally, we closed about $500K from the strategic angels, and we were very, we try to be very like picky about exactly what kind of strategic angels that we would invite to join our cap table, because we wanted to make sure that each investor can really add value in terms of like our growth and traction, right? So a couple people to give you some examples. So we have like a managing partner from SunTrust, which is like the stock analyst equity firm. And then he, the managing partner basically covers all of shopping centers. So he has a really good relationship with the shopping mall owners and operators. So he's able to make that strategic introductions and connections to the right decision makers, right? So that is like the ideal profile of what we look for in terms of our angel investors. And with the fund raise, I think we're going to close closer to like 750K. It's going to basically fund us through our next expansion efforts. So right now we are alive in 4 markets, but we want to cover at least top 20 cities in America by end of Q2 next year. So we're basically going to, we're going through a very aggressive like expansion plan. So that's mainly where, you know, the fund will go. And on top of it, we are basically overhauling some of our products to really streamline and make the launch efforts even more efficient. So that's also another area that we're putting our resources behind.
Got it. And you know, you're part of the XRC Labs, which looks like an accelerator for retail tech startups. Mm-hmm. So can you elaborate more about it, and has somebody from the accelerator joined the board?
How someone from XRC could join my board?
Yeah, no. Do they invest into your startup, and does somebody from the accelerator join the board of your startup, or they are they very passive, you know, investors who handle you at the time of the period you spend time with them? You know.
Got it. Yeah, great question. So, couple of things. So how the XRC works is it's a very similar format to, you know, YC or, you know, Techstars, where, you know, once you are accepted, they basically give you $135,000 as an initial investment. And then, so they basically take equity for that amount. And also they ask you for a separate equity for going through the accelerator. And you basically go through 14 weeks of very intense like coaching from, you know, their mentor network, but also from their founders. And you learn anything and everything from like the branding and growth strategy and financing. And, you know, you basically leverage their network to, you know, really grow your traction and launching new pilots, right? So that's like kind of like a 3-month boot camp as like a startup founder to go through. And after you graduate, you get to, you get exposed to a lot of like different investors who are interested in the retail industry. So they invite a bunch of like VCs and also angel investors to their VC preview day. And basically these investors get sneak peeks into these startups before we are announced through our demo day. So a lot of the companies raise their first round through that. And after that, it's the bootcamp series is over. But I mean, obviously, you can still continue to leverage their network as any way you see fit. And also, you know, like the founders and also like the team stays very active, and they will continue to invite you to like the right event and, you know, connect you to the right people and the right company or target retailers. So yeah, they're very active in helping you grow because they're incentivized to help you grow as quickly as possible.
Got it. And you know, how much did your experience at Peel help you to, you know, really grow the company? Because I didn't talk about, you know, how did you, that you grew the company from $20,000 to $15 million. So any growth hacking strategies, you know, which would help listeners learn about your experience there at Peel?
Yeah, that's a great question. So at Peel, what I really learned was how to grow a sales team from scratch to about, I think by the time I left, we had about 10 people on Salesforce. So just like really learning about like what kind of product to monetize and how to check for like the early product market fit. And once you see that, you know, there are customers out there who wants that product, like how do you scale it up from your internal team side to make sure you're supporting that demand and volume coming through your sales efforts, right? So those three things, I think every founder should know how to sell, because in the early days, you're the only sales force like that your company will have, right? So like me being able to sell to really anyone and understanding like what are the early signals that I should be looking for to make sure that the product has a market. I think that's probably the biggest thing I learned from Peel. The growth hacking part, it came more later when I was actually exploring all different like partnerships to grow my B2B side with Hempster. But at Peel, it was purely kind of like a sales cycle that I really got a lot of exposure to and learned a lot within that company.
Correct. And so let's quickly do the top three. What's your favorite business book?
Yeah. So this probably doesn't count as a business book, but this is like a book that I read whenever I feel kind of burnt out or kind of like really just one of those days where you're like, nothing's working. I don't want to do this anymore. It's called The Lab Girl. And it's basically written by... It's really fascinating because it's written by a like a botanical scientist, and she talks about her experience as a scientist, how she has to go through hours and hours and hours of patience for her to see if she has a product market fit, right? Because she is testing the thesis of like, I have a hypothesis as a scientist. I want to understand if this is right. And how she approaches her problems really spoke to me and really helped me like to think more scientifically and also from like more logical standpoint as a founder. So if there is anyone who is kind of like going through that, you know, slump or, you know, they feel stuck and they feel impatient, I always recommend this book to all my founder friends.
Well, interesting. You know, I've not heard about the book, but I'm going to check it out and, you know, put it for the listeners. So, you know, if you could go back in time when you started Hempster, what is the one thing you would have focused on?
When I first started Hempster, one thing I would have focused on is just identifying the best partners, like who to sell to, right? Like I didn't know who was the decision maker. So I spent a lot of time learning like the org charts of the mall, for example. So when I first launched my Westfield pilot, that was last year in August, it took me a year to get to that point. And in the beginning, because I didn't really know anyone, what I did was I literally went to the mall every day. I went to the stores every day and I got to know their store managers and their assistant store managers and their key holders. And I knew their weekly schedule and I knew their when they were in, when they were out, like, you know, when I should be visiting the store and everything. So while that was a good effort on my part, there's got to be a better way for me to shorten that sales cycle. And I think I was a very eager person and I didn't really logically think it through. So if I could go back, I would just sit my very eager self down and be like, look, it's going to work out. It's going to be fine, but let's like really think through this strategy and figure out what works best for Hemstart.
Current. What's your favorite online tools, example, Gmail or Slack?
My favorite online tool, so it's probably my Google Calendar. I know it's there, it's probably like everyone tells you this, but I live and die by my calendar. And like even my personal life, it's starting to get very organized and I calendar everything. And it actually helps not just to like calendar for your future self, but I've actually noticed that I go back into my calendar in case I need to remember something of like what happened that day, right? Like what happened in that conversation? Like I noticed that I'm using it as a more encompassing tool of like logging my everyday like growth even as a company. And then I would actually like chart my milestones on my calendar because that calendar view just helped me see a little better of like how exactly I'm tracking over like week over week, let's say, or like month over month. So for me, like definitely Google Calendar.
Got it. And you know, how can listeners learn more about Hemstart and, you know, if they want to invest and how can they reach out to you?
Yeah. So I think there's two main things. A lot of the investment information can be found on republic.co/Hemstart. Hemstart as in H-E-M-S-T-E-R. And on there, you can basically check out our like latest growth numbers and our distribution strategy and how the actual ruler sticker works. So if you're curious about that, definitely go to our Republic page. But if you are more curious about like how we are marketing and how we, you know, communicate with our customers, you can definitely go to our website, hemster.co, which is hemster.co.
Well, Alison, thank you very much for coming on to the show. I really appreciate talking to you.
Thank you so much for your time. It was really fun being on your show.
Thanks for listening to the Life Self Mastery podcast, where we teach you how to start and grow your online business. For more information, visit Rohit's blog at www.lifeselfmastery.com.